From the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and where, like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host for the next hour as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode number 34 of Little Brother, dated the 9th of February, 2002. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. Okay, and it looks like I'm on my own this evening, so let's get started. Before we do get started, I need to remind you that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, the WRPI staff or management, or the Rensselaer Student Union. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request airtime for a rebuttal. Also, if you'd like to throw your 2 cents worth in, please feel free to do so. The number here at WRPI is area code 518-276-6248. That number again, 518-276-6248. And last but not least, if you feel like you don't want to put your voice on the air, but you still want to throw your 2 cents worth in, please feel free to send me an email. The email address is critter@verizoneatspoop.com. That's critter, C-R-I-T-T-E-R, at verizoneatspoop, all one word, .com. And, of course, I almost forgot, snail mail. If you really feel you've got to send me snail mail, you can do that too. The snail mail address is Chuck Ritter, care of WRPI, 1 WRPI Plaza, Box 31, Troy, New York, 12180. All right, so let's bring this down a little bit here, and let's get started. Well, there wasn't a Risks Digest this week, so we're going to skip right out on our usual starter. But last week there was some mention of an interesting thing about running TCP IP by way of carrier pigeons, if you can believe that nonsense. Well, I did a little bit of looking around on the web, and sure enough, I found it. RFC number 1149 is a standard for the transmission of IP datagrams on avian carriers, and goes through all the details of how to do it. Basically, take your packet, you print it out, you tape it to the leg of your bird, and you let the bird go. Gets the other end, you scan it, bingo. Well, the Bergen Linux Users Group in Bergen, Norway, actually tried it out. They actually implemented RFC 1149 on April 28th, 2001. It sounds more like something you'd be wanting to do on April 1st, but they started a ping, and they started at about 12:15 in the afternoon. They set the ping interval to 7.5 minutes, and finally, let's see, what did they say here? After manually verifying some OCR and correcting a few mistakes, they the packet was accepted as a valid packet, and there was much cheering about when they saw the message appear on the screen showing that they had, in fact, pinged the other computer by way of carrier pigeon with a ping time of 6,165 seconds. Unbelievable. Let's see here. Got an item from CNET News. They're saying that the attorney for Elcomsoft has filed an action to have the case dismissed, arguing that the law is too vague, too broad, and shouldn't apply to a foreign company. Elcomsoft faces charges of violating the Digital Millennium Copyright Act by selling and conspiring to sell a program that lets people who use Adobe Systems ebook reader copy and print digital books, transfer them to other computers, and have them read out loud by their computer. The Moscow-based software company faces $2.25 million in fines if they're convicted of breaking this law, enacted in 2000 to bar the creation or distribution of technology that can be used to circumvent copyright protections. But defense attorney Joseph Burton of law firm Duane Morris in San Francisco said Elcomsoft makes software that allows people who have lawful rights to copyrighted material to use the material in reasonable ways for personal use. If you have lawful access to the copyrighted material, you can circumvent controls in order to exercise a fair use right, he said. For example, a fair use of an electronic book would be to copy it from a desktop to a laptop for traveling. The problem is that the statute is unclear, he says. Someone that wants to make a tool to allow for fair use cannot tell how to do that without violating the statute. Oh, let's see here. They also filed motions, they said, based on arguments that the law does not apply to a foreign company doing business solely on the internet, and that the company can't be charged with a conspiracy when it involves communication with an employee. A hearing on those motions is scheduled for March 4th. Assistant U.S. Attorney Scott Frewing said that his office had no comment on the motions. There are no plea bargain or other negotiations going on in the government, said Burton. The U.S. government has agreed to drop charges against 27-year-old Elcomsoft employee Dmitry Sklyarov in exchange for his testimony. And as at last report, Dmitry was back home in Moscow. Okay, have an item here that's kind of interesting. This is a letter that was sent out by the Electronic Privacy Information Center to the various attorneys general of the different states. They said, "Dear State Attorney General, the Electronic Privacy Information Center urges you to take action to protect customers against unfair and deceptive trade practices raised by Microsoft Corporation's Passport Services and related Wallet, Kids Passport, Hailstorm, and .NET services. These systems unfairly and deceptively gather personal information and expose consumers to the release, sale, and theft of their personal information. Immediate state action is necessary to protect consumers and ensure Microsoft does not continue to improperly collect personal information. We've repeatedly urged the Federal Trade Commission to investigate this matter in two separate filings, but the Commission has failed to act. We therefore urge you now to institute an investigation under your statutory authority. Passport is a system that enables unprecedented profiling of an individual's browsing and online shopping behaviors. Microsoft has indicated that the company's goal is to have every internet user possess a Passport account, thus raising the possibility that Passport may become the toll booth that controls internet access and online ordering for millions of consumers in your state. By tying Passport to the Microsoft Hotmail email system, online customer support services, over 100 of the largest online retailers, and to numerous exhortations to subscribe in the Windows XP operating system and the Microsoft home site, Microsoft already has acquired over 200 million Passport accounts. The privacy and security risks include online profiling made possible by the requirement that individuals sign on to Passport before viewing web content, an increase in the amount of unsolicited commercial email from the sharing of email addresses in the Passport-affiliated sites, and, most importantly, stolen credit card data from numerous security holes in the Passport and wallet systems. The vulnerability of Passport, combined with its pervasion of the Internet, creates a serious risk to personal information sacrificed by customers to gain access to services integrated with Microsoft authentication software under the belief that Microsoft is adequately protecting their data. Although Microsoft has continually expanded its partnership with online retailers and service, it has done little to improve the protection of consumers' personal information or to provide a reasonable explanation of how the collected data is used or might be used in the future. Instead, Microsoft's current privacy policy and click-through agreements fail to provide an understandable explanation of the company's use of personal data and present a false sense of security. Furthermore, Microsoft continually represents that its Passport service offers customers a secure method for storing personal data and credit card numbers. However, in November, a computer programmer illustrated a serious flaw in the Passport wallet service that could affect 200 million users. By exploiting the flaw, a user's entire Passport account, including credit card numbers stored in the database, could be made public. Microsoft recognized the problem and disabled the wallet service in order to patch the flaw. Since its introduction, consumers using Passport and Windows have been exposed to two major internet viruses, and personal information in Passport was compromised numerous times. Serious questions remain about the security of the Passport and .NET services, yet Microsoft continues to collect personal information. In addition to the unwarranted collection of consumer data, Microsoft offered no method to delete a Passport registration. Microsoft claims that Passport gives users control of their personal information. However, the most basic aspect of control, the right to take back one's personal information, is not accommodated by the Passport system. We notified the Federal Trade Commission of Passport's alleged violations of Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act in a formal complaint on July 26, 2001, and in an updated complaint on August 15, 2001. These complaints, endorsed by 15 leading consumer advocacy groups, describes the serious privacy implications of Microsoft .NET Passport and related .NET services. These complaints urge the FTC to begin a formal investigation. However, the FTC has not taken action. Events since the filing of our complaint with the FTC have made extraordinarily clear that Windows XP and Microsoft Passport raise far-reaching and fundamental privacy and security concerns for American consumers. Microsoft's failure to make public known security risks in Windows XP and Passport and provide a reasonable degree of control of personal information violates state law that prohibits unfair, deceptive trade practices. In light of the FTC's reluctance to address this clear violation of Section 5 of the FTC Act, even after the widely disclosed security flaws, we urge you to investigate the privacy and security risks of Microsoft Passport. The privacy and security of personal information of consumers and of Microsoft products depends upon immediate action. Sincerely, Mark Rotenberg, Executive Director, Chris Hufnagel, Legislative Counsel, and Nathan Mitchler, Law Clerk. This was also sent on to a number of senators. That, again, was a letter that was sent by the Electronic Privacy Information System. The Electronic Privacy Information Center to the attorneys general of the various states of the nation. You're listening to Little Brother on 91.5 FM WRPI in Troy. If you have an opinion you want to throw in about anything that I've spoken about so far, or anything you want me to talk about, or anything you think I'm going to talk, maybe you're psychic, please feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is area code 518-276-6248. 518-276-6248 will put you on the air. A petition lobbying for the use of free software in the German Bundestag has rattled Microsoft Germany sufficiently for the company to retaliate. Microsoft Deutschland chairman and EMEA VP Kurt Seibold has responded to the ringleaders complaining of discrimination and of being accused of being a hindrance to democracy. Now pause while you think about that. Open source software, he continues, is not a per se guarantee of free competition. The campaign is pushing for discrimination against our products and services as being undemocratic and a hindrance to democracy. Seibold may well have justification in feeling somewhat bruised, as the petition itself is rattling good stuff, possibly penned by people who believe that Bill Gates is indeed das Böse, the devil. We believe that in a free market economy, it is the state's duty to prevent the development of monopolies and to grant the possibility of real competition. The public signal of introducing alternative software in such a prominent institution as Parliament would be an easy and practicable step in the direction of a more open market. While free software is not in and of itself a warrant for free competition, in today's situation there seems to be no other alternative to ensure practicable and safe information technology equipment for the legislature. Civic supervision and improvement of software by the general public is only possible using free software due to its openly accessible source code. Short-term disclosure of source codes as offered by Microsoft can only remain patchwork. The democratic aspect cannot be reduced to its mere increased security and flexibility, but is much more the expression of an extended understanding of democracy, encompassing economic and scientific progress. It therefore seems to us that the duty of a democratic state to support the use of open source systems. In support of its case, it cites the introduction of open source in South Korea, its role in the European Commission's e-Europe initiative, and the UK's planned mandatory introduction of open source software in the public sector. We hadn't heard the last one either, nor frankly do we expect to. One of the things likely to have worried Microsoft most is the fact that quite a few of the initial supporters of the petition are Bundestag members, meaning it looks much more like a genuine campaign with heft than just a clutch of crazed visionary lobbyists. It has also almost immediately achieved a high level of support, some of whom seem to be listed here, so it could indeed be a tricky one for Microsoft GmbH. That article was from the Register the 6th of February, and it was titled "Microsoft Chief Lashes Out at German Free Software Petition." You can see it yourself by going to www.theregister.co.uk, and you can make your own opinions known as well by calling us at 518-276-6248. 6248. Got an interesting item here. Google has actually several pages on the topic, but I'm just going to give the brief summary of it here because 4 pages seems a bit excessive. Basically, what Google is running right now is a programming contest with some rather interesting prizes, including some cash prizes, a VIP visit to their headquarters, and the potential to have some of your prize-winning code run on Google's multi-billion document repository, circumstances permitting. Basically, what they're trying to do, they run a program that gathers a selection of information off of the internet. This program is called a ripper, or that's the term they're using for it. It goes around, gathers documents off of the internet, caches them, searches them, organizes them, makes them so that you can go to their site, www.google.com, and search for them. And what this programming contest is to try to do something interesting with the information that's gathered by the Ripper. So if you're interested in that one, you might want to take a visit to Google or take a visit to Slashdot, where this link was posted to the Google programming contest. Okay, here's one to get all the broadband users stirred up, and this one certainly hit home for me. I'm not a subscriber to this particular broadband provider. However, I see this as possibly setting a trend. This came out of the Toronto Globe and Mail. It says Rogers Cable Incorporated is prepared to roll out first-class and coach service for high-speed internet access, spelling big price hikes this fall for bandwidth hogs who download massive amounts of digital music and videos from the web. At the same time, Ontario customers who are light internet users but want high-speed access will get a break on the price. Before September, the Toronto Cable Company will introduce a low-cost service that's cheaper than the current $44.95 monthly cost of Rogers high-speed service. It plans to have 3 groups of high-speed internet customers, each of whom will pay different amounts and in return get different capabilities for moving files. Now, Rogers wouldn't reveal the details of its pricing plan. Industry analysts have made some predictions about what the low-end price will be, and that it'll be comparable to what Bell Canada customers pay for unlimited dial-up access. Alec Krustajic, Rogers Cable's Senior Vice President of Sales and Marketing, has said that as a heavy internet user, he's getting more value out of a high-speed service than somebody who simply checks email and surfs occasionally. Clearly, it's worth more to me than it is to you, he says. Mr. Krastajic said that 10% of Rogers customers use 70% of the capacity. Let me try that one again. 10% customers use for 70% of the capacity. Okay. 10% of the customers account for 70% of the capacity used on the company's network. Analysts said that Rogers' main rival, BCE Incorporated, Bell Canada, will be quick to follow in killing off a one-size-fits-all pricing since both companies' profit margins have been pinched by fierce competition for subscribers. In December, BCE Chairman and Chief Executive Officer Gene Monty mused during a briefing with analysts about the possibility of increasing prices for heavy users. Okay. Now, I can kind of understand the angle that they're coming at this from. I mean, obviously, if you're going into the business of providing internet service, your whole purpose in doing that is to make some money. Now, the question is, if you have a service that started out as a flat rate service, as most of the broadband services are, and as I think to this point, I think up to this point, all of them still are, is it going to be fair to the consumer to make this kind of a change? I don't know. What's your opinion? Tell me. Area code 518-276-6248. If you're a Roadrunner user or an at-home user, if you're listening outside of the immediate listening area, or I think there are a few others out there, Adelphia, Telocity. Well, no, Telocity is now DirecTV. That's all right. But, I mean, if you're the user of one of these miscellaneous services, even Verizon, how would you feel if all of a sudden you had to pay more for a service that you've been getting for typically $40 to $50 a month? I don't know. Here's an item that's a little bit interesting. This one actually was found on the sports page. And it was kind of surprising me to find something of use to me on the sports page, because I'm really not a sports fan. But the idea is that apparently TiVo has been watching the activities of their subscribers, specifically with regards to Super Bowl material. Let's see here. They said the results are in from the digital video recorder set. Britney Spears beat the action on the field in the Super Bowl instant replay stakes. While millions of Americans watched New England beat St. Louis in Sunday's Super Bowl, TiVo Incorporated was monitoring the viewing habits of 10,000 of its 280,000 subscribers. The leading maker of digital video recorders uses its technology to analyze which football plays or TV ads its subscribers choose to view again or to see in slow motion. TiVo viewers did more instant replays of Super Bowl commercials than of the game itself, and the Pepsi ads featuring Spears were the MVP, said John Gashgai. No, that's not his way his name is pronounced. Gashgai, TiVo's director of audience research. Of the football action, Adam Vinatieri's 48-yard field goal as time expired garnered the most replay attention. TiVo did not release actual numbers on how many times viewers used instant replay or slow-mo functions, but it said the special features were used an average of 44 times per household during the broadcast. The analysis, TiVo's largest of a single live television event, is the kind of information broadcasters, content distributors, and advertisers could use to direct tailored messages as more American households embrace digital video recorders. Okay, I'm going to stop there because I think there's an important point that gets missed here. What about the privacy of the individual? Up to this point in time, it has been absolutely between you, your television, anybody else in the house, and anybody that might happen to glance through the picture window, just exactly what it is that you're watching on TV. I think we can safely discount the person who glances through the picture window because that person is being rude. However, when you take a service such as TiVo, first of all, let me back up a second and describe what TiVo is, because I'm sure that there are some people who are not familiar with this service. With a TiVo, you get another black box that you connect up to your TV. It goes alongside your DVD player, your VCR, your cable converter or satellite receiver, and all those other nifty little black boxes that seem to be multiplying next to or on top of your TV. And what the TiVo does is it records video from the television onto a computer hard disk in a digital form. You can play it back later. You can pause live TV and, you know, let's say the phone rings. You can hit a button. It'll pause. It'll continue to record the program that you're watching starting from the instant you hit the pause button. And when you come back, you can hit the pause button again and it'll start to play it back. You can skip commercials as you go along through this. A push of a button will jump you ahead 60 seconds, skipping a commercial, and eventually you'll catch up with the live program again. TiVo's not the only one making such a thing. Microsoft made one for a little while that was called Ultimate TV. That turned out to be not so ultimate after all. It disappeared recently. But then there is Replay TV, and there are a handful of others. Dish PVR, for example. You subscribe to a service that provides listings to your machine via a telephone connection. You have to pay for this service to get the listings. Now they got you. You have a piece of equipment, and you have a service that you have to subscribe to make really good use of the equipment, because what it'll do is it'll go out and it'll record. Say you tell the equipment you like The Simpsons. It'll go out and it'll record every episode of The Simpsons every time it comes on any channel that you get, that is. You have to pay for that listing service. Then they're going to turn around and use the information garnered from what you do with the listing service, and they're going to sell that? Somehow that just does not quite strike me as kosher, and I'm a little bit irritated about that. How do you feel? Give me a call, 518-276-6248. I'd love to hear from you. There was a really interesting idea posted on Slashdot that I think deserves some attention. This was posted by a user who simply calls himself Jamie. He says, think about a class of portable devices that includes storage space, wireless networking such as 802.11b, and user-loadable software. For these devices, why not implement a protocol for ad hoc wireless data sharing, pocket peer-to-peer? This is what I'm imagining. Lots of people carry around pocket peer-to-peer devices hidden in their car, backpack, purse, pocket, hang glider, whatever. Normally, these devices stay half-dormant, listening to see if another pocket peer-to-peer device is in range. When one or more pocket peer-to-peers get within range of each other, they automatically trade their data store with each other. This is a keen glance at a future with enormous consequences. Unless copyright law is drastically extended, a clever hardware hack a decade from now could be the Model A to Napster's Model T. Are we living in the 10-year bubble before the collapse of entertainment media copy prevention? In my humble opinion, this vehicle for data sharing would be very discreet, anonymous, and unstoppable. Your internet service provider would not be involved, so they can't block your traffic. In a sufficiently crowded area of people, it would be difficult to pick out somebody transmitting data and nearly impossible to locate persons storing a copy of said data. Pocket peer-to-peer transfers would be local and spontaneous in nature, so an organization trying to stamp it out would essentially need an enforcement spies everywhere, equipped with RF detection and triangulation tools. The devices for doing this already exist, albeit in slightly suboptimal forms, laptops, palm tops, and PDAs. However, it should not be impossible for enterprising engineers to eventually build more specialized devices towards this goal. Technological predictions are fun and easy. Ethernet NICs cost about $100 10 years ago, and they're $10 now. 802.11b cards right now cost about $100, and they might cost $10 in 2010. So, by then, will some entrepreneur be able to build an MP3 storage or playback device with wireless capability for $50 to $60? Think Sony Walkman that trades music with whatever other devices are around. The hard part is the legal predictions. Right now, the entertainment industry is trying hard to reduce the power of fair use exceptions to copyright law, and thereby expand their own power, and they've made their key weapons things like the DMCA and the doctrine of contributory copyright infringement, going after not the fans, but the corporations that enable music sharing. The corporations that provide your access become the bottleneck that the copyright holders that can control. But suppose somebody did release a Walkman-sized, cheap MP3 player that had a wireless network card used to download legitimately acquired MP3s from your computer. It's not Napster-esque. It's like Apple's AirPort, except it connects wirelessly. That's all. Actually, no, it is like, not like Apple's AirPort, like Apple's iPod. And then suppose it turned out that a simple command given from a computer could trivially put your player into a promiscuous music-sharing mode. The device need not connect to the internet. Perhaps it can't even. It talks to whatever devices are around. It says, I like Jimmy Buffett. Anybody got any Jimmy Buffett? I'll train some Wayne Newton for it. A short-range hardware Nutella. Set some parameters, go for a walk in a public park, come home with some new music, and pass it along. The problem, of course, becomes spam. Come home from the park with ad jingles disguised as Jimmy Buffett. Better to trade at parties with people who are friends and friends of friends. Now, this would surely stretch fair use to the breaking point, but the question becomes, what part of the chain would the copyright holders be able to attack? And with that, we've come to the top of the hour. So I need to tell you that you're listening to 91.5 FM WRPI in Troy. And Little Brother will return momentarily. And we're back to Little Brother on 91.5 FM WRPI Troy. Before we get Continuing again here, I want to remind you that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, the Rensselaer Student Union, or the WRPI staff or management. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request airtime for a rebuttal. If you'd like to throw in your 2 cents worth, please feel free to do so, although it's probably going to cost you a quarter, by calling area code 518-276-6248. That number again, area code 518-276-6248. Or you can send me email at critter@verizoneatspoop.com. That email address again, critter, C-R-I-T-T-E-R, at verizoneatspoop, all one word, .com. Glenn Weiser had an interesting piece in Metroland. He says, let's say you're the computer savvy parent of a daughter who's trying to sell Girl Scout cookies, and you've decided to help her out by setting up a commercial website, shopping cart, and all. You target the local church and community groups as a strong potential market, do some advertising, and watch with satisfaction as the orders start rolling in, but then you get an irate phone call from your minister. He complains that he visited your website, saw a link to the price list highlighted in yellow, and then when he clicked on it, an option to be taken to Asian girls' website, which turned out to be porn. What kind of a filthy pervert are you? He demands. You're bewildered. What happened? Meet Adware, better known as Scumware in more critical circles. This is a virus-like type of software designed to hijack web traffic to commercial sites, and it's bundled in with several popular downloadable programs such as MP3 file sharing programs, instant messaging programs, and Usenet readers. Adware works by installing on a PC owner's hard drive, infecting the Internet Explorer browser, now favored by an estimated 85% of Windows users, when the web surfer visits a site and clicks on a hyperlink or banner ad. Adware attempts to divert him or her to another location, often a porn site, other than the intended by the owner of the site. This victimizes surfers by taking them on surprise detours, and webmasters by sidetracking their visitors. Advertisers are paying Adware companies big bucks to steer traffic their way, and are reportedly quite happily now with how things are going. No one else is, though. The disruption caused by this cyber scourge, critics charge, poses one of the greatest dangers to the Internet today. The best-known forms of this rogue software are the Azula TopText, Gator, and Speedia Surf Plus. TopText works by first changing the typically blue underline beneath a hyperlink to yellow. Then, when the surfer places his or her cursor over the link, a yellow highlight appears over the underlined word or phrase. Clicking on the link then opens up a small window offering a choice between following the original link, which is not named, or the advertiser's link, which is. Gator, on the other hand, plasters its own banner ads over the banner ads on a site. Users clicking on Gator's banners are thus diverted from the websites of the legitimate advertisers. Surf Plus combines spyware and adware functions by showing up on the menu bar of an IE browser, reporting the user's surfing habits back to the advertiser, much as some internet cookies do, and then causing green highlighted links to appear over selected words or phrases in web pages based on the user's known preferences. Both TopText and Gator, for example, are bundled in with the software of LimeWire, a Napster-like MP3 file sharing service. Gator also comes with a game, Snood. Watchdog groups accuse companies like Azula and Gator of stepping on consumers' rights, copyright infringement, owing to the apparent changes of the affected site's content and design, and in the case of Gator, interference in the agreements between advertisers and their affiliate websites. Predictably, adware firms defend their practices as ethical. Yeah, they would. According to CNN, Gator CEO Jeff McFadden says there's no harm with people giving people free software in exchange for viewing ads. In other words, don't look a gift horse in the mouth, even if it's got a contagious disease. Azula spokesman Michelle McGarry says users are told about TopText and it's their choice to opt in or opt out. This, however, fails to consider the plight of the webmasters who are unable to prevent TopText's unwanted links from appearing on their web pages. Now, I can see how that would cause a great deal of confusion. It's just finally gotten to the point now where I've gotten some users that I deal with on a daily basis to comprehend that the problem might not be in their computer, it might be at the other end. Now, I've got to turn this around and express the other way around, that Maybe the webmaster didn't put a link to a porn site on their page. Maybe your computer did. I don't know. I think it's wrong. It's plain and simple wrong. What do you think? 518-276-6248. We'll put you on the air. The Boston Globe is carrying an article about the television industry. Like some universal solvent, digital technology seems to dissolve practically everything it touches. The music recording moguls learned it the hard way as consumers swapped favorite tunes on Napster and burnt pirate CD recordings. Now, it's the TV industry's turn as the digitizers apply their corrosive talents to copying videos. You can smell the aroma of panic wafting from the federal courtroom in Los Angeles, where some major TV producers filed suit against Sonic Blue Incorporated. The California company makes Replay TV, a digital video recorder with features that may delight consumers but terrify broadcasters. For example, the latest version of Replay TV can let the viewer skip over TV commercials without a glance. Moreover, the device allows users to send copies of favorite shows over the internet. Scary stuff for any company looking to protect its intellectual property. But even if you think the broadcasters have a point, it's hard to see how their lawsuit will put a stop to this sort of thing, especially when you consider that millions of personal computers are already capable of similar feats. In essence, Replay TV is a modified personal computer that uses a custom-designed processor to digitize and compress video data and sling it onto the hard drive. Several years ago, when the first such machines were being designed, standard PC processors lacked the muscle to do this work reasonably well. Besides, who'd want to clutter up a PC hard drive with a bunch of old TV shows? But that was before the Pentium 4s, Athlon XPs, and monster chips with clock speeds above a gigahertz. The hard drives got bigger as well. You can buy 100 gigabytes for about $300 these days. Then there are the CD burners that are now standard equipment on home PCs. A high-speed burner can copy 800 megabytes of data in just a few minutes. In short, any late-model PC can double as a Replay TV. All that's needed is a way to pump the TV signal into the computer and the software to digitize and compress it. You can now add both of these accessories to computer for under $100. TV tuner cards for computers have been available for at least a decade and generally sell for about $50. The cards connect to a home TV cable or broadcast antenna and let the user watch TV in an on-screen window while running other computing tasks in the background. And the last piece of the mosaic fell into place last year when Houston-based Snapstream Media unveiled its personal video station software for recording TV shows on the PC. Snapstream PVS lets the user punch in the time and channel information and then order the computer to copy the show. It's even simpler if the computer's connected to the internet. The user goes to a website that displays local TV listings, click on the videotape icon next to the show, and the PVS software is set to record the program in Microsoft Corporation's Windows Media format. Unlike the traditional VCR, Snapstream PVS can be confusing to set up and use, but it works. Video quality varies by how much you compress the signal. A half hour of VHS quality video takes up about 270 megabytes. If your hard drive can stand it, you can make high quality copies. The Snapstream software costs a mere $50, and it can be downloaded from the company's website. Since most PCs don't have TV tuner cards, Snapstream also peddles a hardware and software bundle in retail stores. Adding TiVo-like capabilities to a PC allows for a variety of paradigm-busting applications. Say you've got multiple computers in your home all networked together. The Snapstream software contains a built-in network server, so you can watch a pre-recorded program on any PC in the house. Suppose you own a palm-top computer that runs Microsoft's Pocket PC operating system. Well, you can download a Snapstream video and watch it during the morning commute. Very dangerous idea, I might add. There's just one thing missing, a way to connect your computer to the living room. Snapstream plans to offer just such a device equipped with Wi-Fi-based wireless networking. In effect, the PC will broadcast programs to the TV. There's nothing to stop you from sharing Snapstream videos over the internet. Nothing but bandwidth, that is. Most high-speed home internet services allow rapid downloads but relatively slow uploads. It would take all day to send an episode of Babylon 5 at today's speeds, so there's little chance that TV shows will be Napsterized for now. But you can certainly burn favorite TV shows onto CDs and swap them around. Besides, the broadband lines serving universities and businesses are high-speed in both directions, and video swappers seem to be using them. Already, you can find a great deal of pirated video material online. If SnapStream gets installed on millions of PCs, there'll be plenty more, and the TV moguls will find themselves knee-deep in digital acid bath.
Spiritualism and love.
Okay, got an item from the BBC here. It says a new security hole has been discovered in one of the world's most popular file swapping programs, which could allow anybody to gain private information about millions of users. Security experts have found a way to gain access to the computer hard drives of users of Morpheus, which has taken over from Napster as the leading internet song swapping service. Means that the personal details of up to 2 million people could be exposed to prying eyes. Anytime a weakness like this shows up in a peer-to-peer client, it can damage the credibility of the entire system, said Jack Spratz, a leading file-sharing expert. Damage can range from insignificant for those with PCs whose PCs contain little in the way of personal information, all the way up to severe. It all depends on the contents of the affected user's machine and how much of it they're allowed shared inadvertently or otherwise. Using Morpheus' file-sharing program, people can swap music, videos, or movies with other users of the software. Members of the security group 2600 said they've been investigating this problem since coming across it on Friday. They found it, the preceding Friday. They found a different hole to the one reported several months ago involving a specific computer using the Morpheus program. They found a way to getting random lists of people using the service. They could then obtain details of the files on a user's hard drive and make copies of any file. This includes software installed on the computer or a list of websites that the person visited. We're not sure what this is, what it is that makes some Morpheus members vulnerable to this, said one who asked to remain anonymous. Potentially, this could make every user's computer available to anybody who wants to have a look at it. All we know is that there's a major gap that's allowing certain users to become vulnerable. The group contacted the BBC News Online out of concern about the privacy implications of the security hole. It's definitely an accident from Morpheus' side. This is very dangerous, said the group. BBC News Online tried to contact Morpheus, but no one was available for comment. Napster was shut down by an American court last July for breaching music copyright. The legal status of Morpheus is presently in dispute. Last week, a Dutch court found that a similar file-sharing service, Kazaa, provided software that encouraged copyright infringement. It ordered Kazaa to stop the worldwide distribution of its popular software. The Recording Industry Association of America, which spearheaded the fight against Napster, is reportedly looking at ways it can tackle these new methods of file-sharing.
Meditate. Spiritualism. And love.
Okay, this one's interesting here. An Iowa company is using a new technology that provides cable TV programs and high-speed internet access to homes in small towns over copper telephone lines. The new technology in the future could pose a threat to established cable TV companies such as Mediacom, the largest cable TV provider in Iowa, as well as satellite TV services. Clear Lake, a community served by Mediacom, is the first Iowa community to receive the new digital TV service from West Des Moines-based Iowa Network Services and the Clear Lake Independent Telephone Company. Up to 70 other independent phone companies in mostly rural Iowa are expected to get cable TV programming over Iowa's network fiber optic lines by 2005, said Howard Jewell, a network vice president. Iowa's network is owned by more than 120 of the state's independent phone companies. Using existing copper wires to deliver cable TV and high-speed internet access saves money by eliminating the need to install higher-capacity cables. The new Clear Lake service is a small-scale example of intense competition amongst communications companies and some utilities to become a single provider of a variety of services using a single cable or wire into a customer's home. The new technology used in Clear Lake allows digital TV signals to be compressed and sent over copper wires. It is definitely on the cutting edge, said Ryan Jones, an analyst with the Yankee Group of Boston, a market research firm. Telephone companies are looking at cable television as a new source of revenue, and putting the service into homes over copper wire is a logical idea, said Jones. It will be several years, Jones added, before the service is a serious challenge to large cable companies except in isolated markets. About 85,000 households nationwide currently receive cable TV over telephone lines, but the numbers could grow to 2 million by 2005, said Jones. By comparison, more than 85 million customers get cable TV from the traditional cable companies or direct satellite services. The new service was introduced in January to Clear Lake, population 8,200, and nearby Ventura, population 670. The Clear Lake phone companies won't say how many customers have signed up so far, but a city official said the vote to grant a cable TV franchise to the phone company passed last month by 1,751 to 16. Wow, that's a big council. That sounds like, let's see, the population 8,200 and 670, and they managed to get 17. That's like an eighth of the town. Wow. It said pretty clearly that people want a choice when it comes to their cable TV provider, said Scott Flory, Clear Lake City Administrator. Jones said that fewer than 100 communities nationwide offer cable TV over phone lines. Tom Lowell, general manager of the family-owned Clear Lake Phone Company, said his is the first telephone company in Iowa to offer cable television, high-speed internet access, and regular telephone service over a single copper wire into the customer's home. It's a leap forward to the technology that doesn't exist in most places, said Barry Orenton, a telecommunications professor at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Iowa Network serves 147 rural independent telephone companies that operate in 330 Iowa communities and have 280,000 customers. The digital cable programming is available to Clear Lake and other member phone companies through Iowa's network's statewide system of fiber optic lines. Those lines were built a dozen years ago and can provide voice, video, and internet services. The newest element of the system is a cluster of three satellite dishes at Iowa Network operation in Bonterrant. The systems capture cable TV programming and music audio from satellites that beam signals to cable television operators. Iowa Network, like traditional cable companies, buys the programming from major entertainment companies. The lineup is similar to other cable companies and includes channels such as CNN, Disney, and USA, premium networks such as HBO and Showtime, and audio music channels. It's kind of an interesting concept. This sort of seems like the way that yet another way that you might bring enhanced television service into the rural areas of the country. Right now, I would say about the only way to do that is by satellite. These small dishes. If you go up into the sticks. Go up into, say, Washington County and look around, and you will see a lot of these small 18-inch dishes on several different networks on just about every house you go by. And some of them you'll even see two or three of them, and some of them you will also see some of the older C-band satellite dishes. And that seems to have been the primary way of bringing cable TV, or its equivalent, I should say, out to the rural areas of the country. And this now offers another choice, and I think this sort of diversity is a good thing. I don't know. At any rate, I'm at the bottom of the hour here, so I'm going to take a quick break, and Little Brother will return. And you are listening to Little Brother on 91.5 FM WRPI as we move into our last segment. Tonight, stay tuned at 7 o'clock as the RPI engineers play Clarkson. That again will be at 7 o'clock. This will be an abbreviated segment so that we can get things lined up for the game. And it appears we have a caller on the line. So let's pick up the line and see what we get. Oh, nope, somebody else got it. Okay, never mind that. Well, we seem to be having the bumper crop of stories about personal digital video recorders this evening. So we're going to go next to one from MSNBC about the TiVo. 6 months ago, Kevin Makeley took a TiVo home with him. He set it down in his living room, hooked it up to his TV, and he's been happily obsessed with it ever since. "I love that thing," he says, and why wouldn't he? After all, his $400 investment makes a great companion. It allows the 28-year-old to pause live television when the phone rings or when pizza gets delivered. It stores up to 30 hours of TV shows on its digital hard drive without using a single videotape, and Makeley especially likes the fast-forwarding through all those annoying commercials. There's just one problem: the other woman. He says, "My girlfriend hates it because I'm always on it. I'm always fiddling with it, pulling up the lists, watching one of my shows, or getting into one of hers." She says, "You're not allowed to start 24 until I get home." She shouldn't worry. Her boyfriend records plenty of other programs, too. He has TiVo set to pick up about 10 series a week, including Smallville, Jackass, That 70s Show, Justice League, and NBC's entire Thursday night lineup. His favorite show, The Simpsons, gets recorded whenever it's on. And in New York, where Makeley works as a personal trainer, that's 11 times a week, including syndication. TiVo's the best thing to come out for TV in a long time, he says. So if TiVo is so terrific, why hasn't it, or any of the competitors, taken off? Talk to people like Makeley and you'll hear nothing but accolades, but after 2.5 years on the market, less than 300,000 TiVo systems have been sold. The company's two main competitors, Ultimate TV and Replay TV, won't even release sales figures. They're estimated to have sold less than 100,000 units apiece. Clearly, the companies are struggling. Just last week, Microsoft restructured Ultimate TV, cutting more than 150 jobs from the troubled unit. Analysts point to a few possible factors for the slow sales. First, there's the price. They're going to be very popular, but they're too expensive at the moment. Burnoff, a TV analyst at Forrester Research, said, indeed, models of TiVo now costing from $299 to $599, Ultimate TV from $199 to $449, and Replay costing between $699 and $1999. DVRs are also relatively complicated to set up. Wiring it to a TV is tricky, says Burnoff, and the more sophisticated the TV, the harder it is. Even more damaging, the general public still doesn't comprehend how DVRs work. Many people simply don't understand what one of these does. That's criminal, because what it does is so simple. But when you look back at the ads for TiVo and Replay TV, when they first came out, they said, "Pause live TV." And consumers thought, why would I want to do that? Other analysts go a step further. The marketing has not only been poor, they say it's targeted at the wrong people. Data from Odyssey, an independent market research firm, shows that those who know the best about DVRs have annual household incomes of $75,000 and above, but knowledge doesn't necessarily translate into sales. Marketing these products only to wealthier households, whether intended or not, shows a complete failure in their ability to reach their most important customers, says Sean Bannon, managing director of Odyssey. At the end of the day, DVRs are ingenious, but they're not about technology or gadgetry. They're about better television. You might have an income of $25,000, but I'd rather have a better TV than an AC that works. One last item plaguing DVRs. TV executives have had a rocky history with the machines. Despite the major network's initial investment in the technology 3 years ago, they could stand to lose serious earnings if DVRs become very popular, at least in the short run. With more and more people skipping through the commercials, the economic foundation of the TV industry could be jeopardized. In fact, last fall's release of the Replay TV 4000 got the network so amped up that they sued. The newest model, which allows users to email recorded shows to each other via the internet, led to major networks to file a lawsuit still pending against replay maker Sonic Blue. The networks claim the technology violates copyright laws and robs them of revenue. Well, that's about all the time we have today, so we're going to break it down and get things handed off in preparation for tonight's game against Clarkson. So stay tuned to 91.5 FM WRPI Troy, and I'll catch you this time next week.